This podcast is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity, like Progressive Home and Auto Policies. They're best when bundled, too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Hey, I'm Rachel Hampton.
And I'm Candace Lim, and you're listening to ICYMI.
In case you missed it.
Slate's podcast about internet culture.
And this week, we've got something super fun cooked up for y'all. Today, we've got Mike Rugnetta in the studio with us. Mike is an audio extraordinaire. He created the Sound Studies podcast, Reasonably Sound. He's consulted, produced, and executive produced on a number of podcasts, including the Long Reads podcast. And he's the co-host of Never Post, an incredible new podcast about the internet that launched this year. We are collaborating with Mike and the Never Post team to bring you this week's episode. But before we get into the magic we have made together, let's welcome Mike to the show. Mike, hello.
Hello. It's very, very nice to be here.
Oh, we're so excited to have you here, Mike. And we do have to ask you the question we ask all of our first-time guests, which is, what's your first internet memory?
So knowing this was coming, I racked my brain trying to figure out, you know, what comes before what. They're so old at this point. They all kind of like glom together. And I think my earliest memory is my cousin, his family, his house, they had internet before we did. And he lived like half a mile down the street from me. So we were in the computer room on what browser? I couldn't tell you. Maybe Internet Explorer. Like, this would have been like 1993, maybe 1994. Just literally like typing things into the location bar, trying to see if they were websites.
Oh.
Like random, just like words and phrases, .com, just to see what was out there.
I have been there. My first website that I went to consistently was a website that me and my older brother found called stupid.com, which lets you know that we were doing the exact same thing that you and your cousin were doing. We have one other question for you that we think is probably relevant to today's episode, a little teaser, which is, what is your first memory of the British royal family?
I have an early memory of being like maybe 9 years old, visiting London with my parents and seeing Buckingham Palace and knowing that like important people live in there and that they're royals. But I think probably my first memory of a member of the royal family as an individual person was, it's got to be the death of Diana. I don't think it's anything else. It's got to be that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I actually want to ask you that question as well, Candace, because both of us were perhaps not holding our heads up at the time that Princess Diana died. And you've said on the pod before that you were up at the ass crack of dawn to watch Kate and William's wedding, which, you know, suggests to me that you had some familiarity with them before that auspicious day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've been a royal watcher for about 13 years now, and I will say, I think this all started near the womb for me, because the first rule of immigrant culture is you never get over Princess Diana. And so I was born the same year she died. It has been trained into me that you just never stop talking about it. It is a thing that will unite all immigrant mothers and women together. It's in the fabric of our lives. But what about you, Rachel?
I've been thinking about this for a while because I'm pretty sure I encountered news about the royal family while, you know, browsing tabloids in the grocery store line while you were waiting for your mom to check out, or while you were panicking because she left you at the line to go pick something else. And you're like, I don't have money. I'm a child. Got stressed thinking about that. But honestly, the moment that I think I first fully recall might have been Kate and William's wedding, honestly.
Sure.
I really don't think I started tapping in until Meghan Markle arrived on the scene. And despite the fact that I feel like a lot of Black women, like American Black women, also feel a deep kinship with Princess Diana, along with like immigrants of the British Empire, I wasn't really paying attention for a really long time. And I don't think my family cared that much either.
Yeah. Well, we're talking about the royal family today because that is the topic of today and Saturday's episodes.
So ICYMI and Never Post, we have been tossing around an idea for a collaboration since February. And over the course of a bunch of meetings, emails, all the calendar invites you can imagine, the thing that we keep coming back to, which I think was the first thing that we ever even talked about.
Yeah.
It's the royal family. Specifically the massive hullabaloo around the whereabouts, the mystery surrounding the Princess of Wales, Kate Middleton.
Yeah, I think it really got all of us interested as soon as we brought it up in the meetings.
It was definitely like a spark of a moment. Very clear that we all had something to say. So it's been, at the time that we're recording this, it's been just over a month since Kate announced that she started chemotherapy treatments following a cancer diagnosis, which means that it's also been just over a month since conspiracy theories about the princess ran rampant across the internet, inspired by the fact that before her March announcement, Kate hadn't been seen publicly since Christmas of 2023. So a long, long time disappeared.
And the palace had forewarned that due to an abdominal surgery operation planned for January, it was unlikely that Kate would resume her public duties until Easter. And as Constance Grady over at Vox wrote, quote, although Kate stuck to her schedule, the long pause in her public appearances and the lack of concrete information about her health created a fertile breeding ground for conspiracy theories when Prince William canceled a planned appearance of his own on February 27th, citing a personal matter, rumors began to fly.
Rumors that y'all might remember we touched on here on ICYMI. Famously, I thought she was getting a BBL, and we promised to discuss this more in depth, but in light of Kate's cancer announcement, we wanted to take a step back and really think about how and why things shook out the way they did. Why did Kate's disappearance from public duties engender so much speculation? How did the royal family, one of the longest enduring institutions in human history, manage to successfully manage a news cycle around Charles's cancer diagnosis and so spectacularly fuck up the one around Kate's? And my personal most important question, am I a bad person for taking joy in the rumors that suggested Kate was off getting a BBL?
The question that our teams keep coming back to are really broad, which are basically, it's like in an increasingly algorithmic internet, as we get siloed further and further into our own little content niches, all consuming events like Kate Middleton's cancer diagnosis, these events that capture the attention of broad swaths of the public, those feel like those are fewer and further between. So we were just wondering, like, what does it take in 2024 to do that? What is the recipe for these rare monocultural moments?
And we're going to answer all of these questions after a short break.
Hey, y'all. If you love our podcast, then please consider subscribing to Slate Plus. When you subscribe to Slate Plus, you get no ads on a new Slate podcast, including this one. You will also be supporting the show. ICYMI and its collaborations would not be possible without the support of Slate Plus subscribers. You will also get bonus segments or episodes on shows like Slow Burn, Amicus, Culture Gap Fest, Hit Parade, Big Mood, Little Mood, so many shows. You'll also get unlimited reading on the Slate website, which means you get access to every single article and advice column on Slate without ever hitting the paywall. To sign up, just visit slate.com/ICYMI+. That is slate.com/ICYMI+. Did you know that 35% of adults report experiencing poor sleep quality? Discover the secret to better sleep with Cozy Earth's luxurious bedding products. I have been obsessed with my Cozy Earth sheets since I received them. I have been so excited every time I get to put them on my bed. The very first time I touched them, I think I actually gasped out loud at just how soft they were. They've been so nice as the weather has been warming up here in New York because they're really nice and cool. I'm really obsessed. Cozy Earth bedding products are crafted with temperature regulating technology, which means they adapt to your body's needs, ensuring a sleep experience tailored to you. They use only the very best fabrics, materials, and weaves, offering superior softness that invites you to sink into a world of comfort. Enjoy a 100-night sleep trial and a 10-year warranty on all purchases. That is a decade of unparalleled comfort and support. Incorporating Cozy Earth products into your self-care routine can enhance your sleep quality and overall wellness. Treat yourself to ultimate comfort with Cozy Earth bedding and sleepwear and prioritize your self-care and sleep health. Head over to CozyEarth.com and use promo code ONLINE for an exclusive 35% off. Upgrade your nights, transform your days with Cozy Earth.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And we're back. So one of my favorite discussions we had while figuring out this episode was kind of ruminating on what a moment needed to be monocultural, both historically and in this current internet age. And we came up with this taxonomy of sorts, which I'm obsessed with. Basically 5 to 6 key ingredients that are needed for an event to go from sort of a big deal to something that it seems like everyone is talking about. Think Ocean Gate, think Fire Festival, think big boat stuck in the Suez Canal. Words or phrases that immediately conjure a memory of feverishly scrolling Twitter or TikTok for more information, more jokes, more theories.
Right. Which brings us to the first ingredient of the monocultural moment recipe that we came up with, the gap. Not the one in the mall, but the one in understanding, an information vacuum, something that feels increasingly rare online. If anything, I think often the opposite is true. I want to know less about the stuff that I see in my feed.
Same. We should all know less about each other.
Yeah. It's too much. With Ocean Gate, for example, the viewing public had 4 days between the submersible losing contact with its mothership to then divers finding the debris field. News outlets, however, ran with the story immediately. The New York Times had a live blog. There were countdown clocks for oxygen levels. Countless experts conveyor belted by to explain everything from the mechanics of an implosion to the history of deep sea rescues.
There was a sort of perfect paradoxical moment in those 4 days where we were being bombarded with, or in my case, seeking out a lot of information on concepts like the abyssal zone and the difference between, you know, a giant and a colossal squid, the family tree of king princess. But none of the information was about what we kind of actually cared about, which was the fates of the passengers on the submersible.
Mm-hmm. And I want to hone in on that paradox for a moment, because like Mike said, the overwhelming experience of being on the internet today is being bombarded with too much information. I think there's this real way that people's brains break a little bit when something isn't discoverable on the internet. And they go, well, maybe you haven't found the answer, but I will. And I think that's kind of where the theories start forming.
Yes, exactly. Which brings us to the second ingredient in the recipe, clear and recognizable characters. So with Ocean Gate, There was the company CEO, Stockton Rush, who you might have heard was married to the great-great-granddaughter of Ida and Isidore Strauss, one-time owner of the Macy's department store, and both of whom died on the Titanic, the wreckage of which was, of course, the sub's final destination. James Cameron himself could not have scripted a better character to be at the center of this deep sea tragedy. Also, Final Destination, too much, okay? Too much?
I love it. I mentioned the boat stuck in the Suez Canal at the top of this segment. I think in lieu of any immediate hero or anti-hero, the boat itself, the Ever Given, ended up taking on some anthropomorphic qualities during the 6 days when it was run aground, which, can we pause and remember that that only lasted 6 days? I thought it was a month. I looked back and was like, oh, that lasted for a whole month, right? No, it was 6 days.
It felt like an age, yeah.
But the girlies were out here writing fan fiction about the Ever Given and the Suez Canal together. So even if there aren't human characters as compelling as Stockton Rush, we will make some up.
And the next two requirements we have on our list, I think, actually fall under the heading of characters, because for every hero, you need an anti-hero, which means for every monocultural event, it's even better if there are perpetrators and if those perpetrators are rich people.
Yes, totally.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned Fyre Festival as one of these monocultural internet events. You know, the perpetrator there was clearly Billy McFarlane, and he somehow managed to give us a golden moment where a rich person was scamming other rich people. Like, I don't think that would have been nearly as big of a deal if the people involved hadn't spent thousands of dollars to go to this festival. There was a real eat the rich vibe.
And I mean, you know, what else would they have eaten on that island? We all saw pictures of those sandwiches.
We did.
The sad salad really is stuck in my brain. Yeah. Oceangate also had a similar vibe, I think. There wasn't a lot of love lost as far as the public was concerned for the hubristic founder, heir to dual fortunes, both Macy's and Stockton Rush's, I think, great-grandfather was the one-time director of Standard Oil, or his passengers who were paying $250,000 to do something that most people wouldn't do if you paid them $250,000. And the counterexample, I think, is like a lot of interest in the Key Bridge collapsing disappeared as soon as it became clear that most of the victims were undocumented immigrants, the men who were working on the bridge at the time that it collapsed. And I think, you know, you could argue that that's because people don't care about the working class. They don't care about the immigrant population. But I think you could also argue that, like, the story didn't really have legs because people aren't interested in a tragedy that doesn't have imminently dunk-onable characters.
I think you're right. We want to kind of feel guilt-free in our dunking, which makes me want to ask, do we still think the Ever Given counts as one of these monocultural moments? Because I don't know if there were perpetrators or rich people necessarily involved in that one.
I could see it both ways. I think there is maybe something fundamentally hubristic about global logistics. That it's like, you know, the giant container ship moving massive amounts of product is, it really gives you an insight into how fragile the things that we think of as being very normal really are. And the, like, structures that allow those things to exist are just like these massive, massive companies that are putting a giant boat in probably a slightly too big canal. And so, like, you know, you could get this sense of like, listen, everybody's just got to calm down a little bit. You know, we're doing too much.
Yeah, there's definitely this idea of, like, all of these people involved who are, quote, losing money from this are like shipping magnates. They're fine. They have other boats. They have other big boxes. I will also say, as we go through this list of tenants, I think as long as you hit like an 80% mark, you know, you hit at least 80%, then we're going to give you the monoculture status. And therefore, I think it counts.
I love it. We're grading on a curve here. I have one more question, which it seems like we as a culture are really interested in seeing rich people suffer. Like, what we're talking about here is that for a monocultural moment to really succeed, there has to be a rich person, perhaps dying, but definitely flopping publicly. Mm-hmm. Why do we think that is?
I think lack of empathy is one thing. This idea that if you have everything in the world, from privilege to the riches to just like a safety net onto which you can fall, can you really flop so hard it would destroy you? Can you really?
I think a lot of people feel really powerless in the world, and they feel like there's nothing really they can do to escape their lot, and that they are constantly shown images of people who are doing a lot better than them. And especially as far as like finance and corporate culture is concerned, it's like these are people who control a lot of the world. And you hear a lot about the things that people who run large companies do to maximize profits at the cost of the livelihoods of their employees, their quality of their life, you know, their working conditions. It feels like it's just so hard to fix. It doesn't feel like it's something that you can like ever really do anything about. And it feels like for a lot of those people, especially for the ultra wealthy, there are no consequences. So the moment that there's like any kind of consequences, especially if they're related to something that seems like a bad idea to begin with, I think all bets are off. I think people just feel like, you know, you got what you deserved. You should have known better. You shouldn't have played. You fucked around. You found out. Like there's no other way to put it.
As we ponder why rich people do what they do, I do want to ask, what is next on our taxonomy?
Okay. So this is my personal favorite on this list, and I think my most strongly held requirement on this list for what makes a monocultural moment, which is someone needs to be stuck inside something. Someone needs to have disappeared. Fire Festival, they were on an island. There's literal movies about this. Castaway, Ocean Gate, the boat stuck in a canal. One event we haven't talked about that I also think fits within this rubric is the rescue of that soccer team that was stuck in a cave in Thailand in 2018, which I fully remember taking over my entire social media timeline.
Mm-hmm. And we cannot forget about Balloon Boy, which, by the way, even though Rachel and I were kind of in high school or something, we were definitely using the internet. I don't remember the details of this, but Mike, by any chance, do you have like a Spark Notes version of what happened?
Yeah, I think actually I was working at Know Your Meme the year that this happened. So this was something that I thought like was thinking about and watching unfold as it was occurring. In 2009, two parents in Colorado released this like saucer type looking balloon into the air. And one of their kids says, "Hey, I think I saw my brother Falcon get in there," which is, this is the detail of the story that like has really stuck with me. Actually, there's two. The first is the father was like a notorious showman. Like he always had a lot of schemes and plans that he was going to get rich. Anyways, so one of the kids says, "I think Falcon is in the balloon." The parents freak out. They call the authorities. The FAA launches a search for the balloon. Like they literally, they're scrambling jets. This, of course, becomes a news story. So people are watching the escort that this balloon has, potentially with a kid in it, you know, with all of these jets. At some point, there's questions about whether or not Falcon had fallen from the balloon. So like, do we have to go search for him in the woods? Eventually, the balloon lands. It glides down to Denver International Airport. It gets opened. People get to it. And there is no boy in the balloon. Sans boy.
Wow.
And that is because he was hiding in the house the entire time.
Oh, my God.
So the sheriff, the police in the district declared this a hoax, and both of the parents got jail time. If this were to happen today, like, can you imagine Balloon Boy on TikTok? What's Balloon Boy talk like?
I think it would be everyone's Halloween costume.
100%. We would be getting photos, videos of people saying the balloon just went over my neighborhood. I feel like this just further proves my point, which is we as a species love when someone is stuck inside something, just waiting to be rescued. I mean, Rapunzel, come on. Little Timmy down that well. Lassie saved him, I'm sure. Balloon Boy, Thai soccer team, Ocean Gate. What more do you need? We love the drama of being stuck.
And Rachel, why do you think that is?
So I'm going to put on my psychologist hat and say I think it taps into a primal fear of enclosed spaces. But more importantly, I think it taps into our desire to backseat drive. I think we love to watch an expert do something, like rescue someone else, and think, I could do that better. Mm-hmm. Like, most of us ignore that urge, but if y'all remember the rescue of the soccer team, there was one person who couldn't shut their goddamn mouth about how they would do it better.
Which brings us to our next ingredient in the recipe, which unfortunately is Elon Musk. The moment that Elon enters the chat on any given event is the moment that it has escaped containment or is a symbol that it very recently has. There's two parts of this. Like, Elon is a well-known figure. He's famous. He's got a large audience. So, you know, his reach is broad. But I think the other part of it also is that a lot of that audience is very sycophantic. They are obsessed with Elon, what he has to say. They think that his approach to things is impeccable, unimpeachable. They hang on his every word. They repeat a lot of what he says. So I think, you know, his fame is very internet-based. His fans are terminally online. So I think he's a powerful force for forcing something into the limelight.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I don't know if there's anybody else that I can think of who has an audience whose primary characteristic is being terminally online, mm-hmm. like Elon does. So there is just a real quality to him talking about something that just means, well, I guess that's not just national news, but international news now.
Yeah. Okay. So Elon has to enter the chat. And now for the final ingredient needed for a monocultural moment in 2024, which is the inflection point into tragedy. Importantly, almost none of the moments we've mentioned thus far have been like positive. Like, you know, yeah, the big boat, it got unstuck. Yeah, the kids made it out of the cave. No one died at Fyre Festival. But all of these events either have a whiff of tragedy about them or they eventually become tragedies like Ocean Gate.
I have a feeling that positive moments just don't hold our attention for nearly as long.
Yeah.
But I want to test this theory out and ask, do y'all feel like Harry and Meghan's wedding was as big of a deal as Megxit was, which I feel like they both have 80% of the things we're talking about in our rubric. Mm-hmm. Or maybe do royal weddings just kind of break our rubric because it's a royal wedding?
Yeah, this is interesting because I think underneath both of these events, the subtext is that they are both political, they are both economic, and the perpetrators switch. So what I mean by that is I think both were covertly political in a way where like the wedding was seen as this politically positive event. You know, we are 2 years into Trump. Boris Johnson is about to become prime minister the following year. And so this was kind of this like international event that everyone could agree was a transatlantic union. It was a celebration, you know, for someone that came from here, America, and married this boy whose mother we all loved. Then you go to Megxit, which became this very politically negative story that had been kind of brewing for a while until the British tabloids named it. And I think the wedding needed to happen for Megxit to happen, meaning the British tabloids have this tendency to like love you one day, tear you down the next. And I think Megxit was just more controversial than the wedding because of that longer tail, the way that it was so clearly defining this rift in like British American unions, the way that the 2018 one was. Mm. Although I do want to note that like there was a lot of racist and sexist commentary happening leading up to the wedding. This time, though, I think it gave validation to those people coming out for a second time.
Well, I think now is as good of a time as any to really, really put our taxonomy to the test, which, you know, just to repeat, what we have decided we needed for a monocultural moment in 2024, it's about 5 or 6 events. There needs to be an information gap, compelling characters, hopefully rich people, and hopefully those rich people are perpetrating a crime that we can all point and laugh at. My personal favorite, someone trapped in something. And then the bonus A+, Elon Musk chiming in. The final necessary step. the inflection point into tragedy. So that's what we've got so far. And I feel like Kate Middleton has almost all of these, but we'll find out after a short break.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And we're back. So we just broke down the 5 or 6-ish components that we came together as a brain trust and figured out that we need to make a perfect monocultural event. There's the information gap, compelling characters, preferably rich people. We need perpetrators, someone trapped inside something, the Elon Musk appearance for, you know, the gold star, and the inflection point into tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Which brings us to what will probably be 2024's most talked about monoculture event, QAnon.
The 2 months when Kate Middleton went missing.
Right. And to be fair, as we all try to forget, 2024 is an American election year. So historians will probably be writing a lot of books about that. But this event, as in the 2 months when Kate Middleton went missing, was an international monoculture moment, one that hits the ground, the internet, and the world. So first, Candace, as I would say, the royal watcher in the chat, can you walk us through the Kate Middleton timeline?
Absolutely. So I'd say the story started back Christmas Day 2023, which was and still is, as the day of this taping, the last time we have seen Kate Middleton live in public. Now, this was the annual royal family walk when they go to church on Christmas morning. It's a whole thing. Then we go to January 2024, when Kensington Palace announces that Kate has undergone a planned abdominal surgery. She'll be in the hospital for 10 to 14 days before recovering at home. They say she'll have to postpone some events, so she'll be back after Easter. So she'll be gone for like 10-ish weeks.
And to be honest, it is not wild for royal family members to lay low for long periods. They're not in the public eye 24/7. So Kate could get away with making herself scarce for a little while.
Mm-hmm. Until February 27th, when suspicions arise, because Prince William pulls out of a funeral for his godfather only like an hour before the ceremony starts. You know, his reps are claiming it's a personal matter, and then the theories start jumping out. Why did he pull out? How personal was the matter? Wait a minute, where's Kate? We haven't seen her for like 63 days. Now, I want to throw in here that I recently had a British citizen talk to me, and they told me that they personally believe that the Kate conspiracy theories peaked on like February 29th because it was leap day. And their whole thing is like, we had this extra day, we didn't know what to do with the extra time, so therefore we spiraled. But back to the timeline. Look, speculation is rising. BBL theories are growing. And on February 29th, Kensington Palace gives a statement to Page Six saying, Kensington Palace made it clear in January the timelines of the princess's recovery and we'd only be providing significant updates. That guidance stands.
I feel like now is a good time to start matching this timeline with our monocultural checklist. So first off, was there an information gap?
Yes.
Absolutely. I would say that that gap started when Prince William pulled out of the funeral, which is just generally kind of suspicious. In any situation, that raises a lot of questions. But then the palace says, everything's fine, don't worry about it. This is definitely where the gap starts to open, and also where we start to get literal palace intrigue.
Yeah. And maybe we should start taking down some names, aka talking about the characters, because while this is going on, for like 1 second, the bigger news was that King Charles had been diagnosed with a form of cancer.
And that's a big deal. He is, you know, not just a head of state, but the head of state for, you know, a top five world power.
And even though the king being ill is like logistically, politically, economically significant, you know, it's interesting how he becomes kind of like a side character to Kate's plot line, right? So like, this is the thing. It's like they kind of switch them. So to some, he becomes an extra. To others, he becomes a villain. He's trying to take the focus off of himself as he tries to deal with his own illness. You know, is this all kind of like on purpose? You know, are these the gears of the royal family turning?
Yeah. So we have Kate, King Charles, Prince William, who has also kind of been cast as both victim and vilified, meaning I think Prince William got a real beating in the press ever since Prince Harry got married, from cheating allegations to I threw my brother into a dog bowl allegations to Cadenon, where he was hit yet again with cheating allegations. Like, that information gap we are speaking of gave us characters, but it didn't give us narrative. So everything we've ever thought about William, anything you've ever felt about him, was now considered evidence when we started like filling in the blanks. Then we have Camilla, who I think weirdly came off quite innocently in this whole kerfuffle. Like, yes, there was that very funny tweet about her saltburning the royal family. But the thing is, she has been like laying low, taking care of her man, kind of waiting for the palace to deploy her as needed. To me, I think the reason no one's really checking for Camilla or like trying to place her in this narrative is because she never gets the good information. You know, she started off as like a liability to the palace, especially when Charles was still married to Princess Diana. So to me, she doesn't have the tea.
And I think we should also maybe strike Prince Harry and Meghan Markle from this cast list of characters, right?
Yeah, I'm a little shocked about how uninvolved they became in this, because, you know, Prince Harry did fly to the UK for like 24 hours when his father announced his diagnosis. We later found out that Harry and Meghan were never personally notified of Kate's well-being. They found out via the news, like us. But they somehow kind of excluded themselves from the narrative, which I guess is good because Meghan needs to harvest her jam.
So there's a missing portion here, I think, and that's the Middleton side of the family, right? They had a part in this.
Yeah. I mean, Pippa, Carol, the mom, what are they doing?
Yeah. So let's jump to the timeline a bit. On March 4th, it's been about a week since Prince William dropped out of that funeral. Kate is seen for the first time. She is wearing sunglasses in the passenger seat of a car driven by her mother, Carol. And look, it is this telephoto paparazzi photo of them in an Audi near Windsor Castle. But do you guys remember the reaction to this photo?
Yeah, this is the one. There was the massive argument online about whether or not it was actually her. And all of the stories that you could fit within that, like, is that just not her? Is that someone pretending to be her? Is it her, but she's like wearing something that's hiding some sort of medical procedure that she's had? It's like every question you could possibly fit into grainy photo.
I feel like I saw everything from it's a body double to these pixels, they aren't matching up. That's a clear Photoshop job. I will admit the photos were blurry and I don't know how sanctioned they were by the palace, but this photo of Kate that was probably supposed to clear the she was gone girl allegations, I feel like only added to the flame.
It's the rare piece of media that in this situation like tries to answer questions, but just creates so much more of them.
Yeah. So now we have the theories that the mom is complicit, helping drive a body double across the UK. And then let's talk about Pippa, who is her sister, because one small sub-character that kind of pops up is a family friend named Thomas Kingston, who died of suicide before William dropped out of the funeral. So for a second, people were like, did William drop out after hearing that news? Because they are technically related. Thomas was married to the daughter of Queen Elizabeth's cousin, but they weren't just friends. And they weren't just family.
They were a secret third thing.
They were roommates.
Close. Thomas allegedly used to date Pippa. So now the conspiracy theory is, did the palace allow Kate intrigue to run rampant to cover up the suicide of a low-level family member?
Which is maybe unlikely, because it's usually the other way around, where they use low-level drama to cover higher-level drama, like when Meghan Markle stories were being planted to cover the William Chumley cheating allegations.
So is there anyone else that we need to bring into the story?
I mean, perchance, but I think to wrap up the container of these characters, I think it's important to note that everyone involved is rich, wealthy, of high society, in the upper echelons of Britain's ruling class. And that is another monoculture moment signifier, that we tend to care about rich people more than normies because we want to eat them without feeling bad about it.
So in that case, who would the perpetrators be?
I feel like a perpetrator implies someone did something wrong, a kind of villain of sorts. And it seems like we're casting about in this cast of characters for a villain. We haven't mentioned anyone yet who are like, innocent.
Yeah. And I think people were definitely looking for that villain. They were trying to figure out, okay, who's hiding Kate? Who put her away? Who gone girled her?
So then this is where we can start talking about the Instagram photo, right?
Because on March 10th, Mother's Day in the UK, Kensington Palace posts a photo on Instagram of Kate sitting on a chair with her three kids around her. And the caption says, quote, "Thank you for your kind wishes and continued support over the last 2 months. Wishing everyone a happy Mother's Day, -C." And this is when things explode. Why?
I mean, people started taking a microscope to this photo and saying, hold up a second. My familiarity with Photoshop was honed on Tumblr, but even I know something's wrong here.
There was a lot wrong with that photo.
Yeah.
Like really, like Bush League, hilarious Photoshop errors. Back in my day, we would say you could tell from the pixels.
And you can tell from the pixels. There were pixels missing. Charlotte's hair is off. There's a sleeve that's wrong. There's been some deeply distressing Photoshop happening on this photo. It's giving AI-generated photo. And the worst part is that all the people noticing this aren't random cranks on the internet. I mean, they are, but they were right.
Because soon after, the Associated Press issues a kill notification on the photo saying that upon closer inspection, it appears that the source has manipulated the image. No replacement photo will be sent.
Which means, in, you know, non-journalistic language, don't use a photo. It's bad.
And it gets worse.
Because the palace confirms it. Kensington Palace tweets, quote, "Like many amateur photographers, I do occasionally experiment with editing. I wanted to express my apologies for any confusion the family photograph we shared yesterday caused. I hope everyone celebrating had a very happy Mother's Day. See?"
So, I mean, this is the moment where the whole thing goes off to the races, because there's so many questions about what is happening that it's not whether you believe a conspiracy theory. It's which conspiracy theory at this point have you chosen to believe? Because top to bottom, tip to tail, like the whole thing is really suspicious. There's obviously something going on here. And I think, you know, everybody's natural curiosity just kicks in. You start to look for like, what could possibly be actually happening? But I think we still haven't really like pinned down that one thing. Who's the villain? Who's the bad guy?
Well, the caption of this altered photo claims that it was taken by Prince William. So even though C, which stands for Catherine, her real name starts with a C, claims to have taken credit for the bad Photoshop, this adds to the Prince William pile of like, oh, he definitely conquered her. You know, he's behind the Photoshop. He is behind it all. And I think he did emerge as like the prime perpetrator number one.
Because speaking of photos, should we mention that video posted about a week after the Photoshop disaster where someone claimed they saw Kate Middleton and Prince William walking through a farmer's market?
I do. I think it's Kate Middleton now. At the time, I was willing to be convinced that it was not.
Same.
I was open to the suggestion that something nefarious was happening. But now I'm like, that's probably Kate.
Other than Prince William, do you guys have any other perpetrators we should list?
I mean, the palace, like capital P, the palace TM.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think I have a very similar answer, which is just like monarchy. You know, like the whole arrangement sort of forces this sort of very strange palace intrigue, power jockeying, secrecy. It's kind of like required for the whole setup.
Yeah. And here's the thing. I kind of want to move on to the next monoculture signifier, which is, does this story include someone who was trapped in something?
I mean, if you consider being trapped in a marriage as being trapped, I would say yes. Trapped within an institution, yes.
Yeah, again, I agree with Rachel on all counts. I think that, it, you know, when the mystery was at its highest, you could imagine all sorts of places that, you know, she might have been trapped either against her will or for any kinds of reasons, you know, not choosing to not leave, medical reasons, personal reasons, emotional reasons. And I think, yeah, like trapped within an institution, trapped within the royal family, trapped within monarchy, trapped in a lot of ways, like behind a veil that forces a kind of opacity of communication. It feels like if she actually did have a conduit to speak earnestly with the public, that that might be easier, but that's just not how this works. And I think that that really comes across as a kind of being stuck or being trapped.
Yeah. And to be trapped is not repression, but suppression. And I think that tracked because a lot of people were like, there are outside forces controlling this. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I do have to ask the other question, which is, does Elon Musk ever enter the chat?
I don't think so. I mean, other than obviously Twitter, the site that he owns that is allegedly now called X, being rife with conspiracy theorists, including our own beloved coworkers and me. So sort of.
Yeah.
I went and looked. I looked last night. I went and searched all of his tweets to see whether or not he had issued any statement regarding the royal family, Kate Middleton, like any of this. He hasn't said, he never tweeted anything. I think the last time he tweeted about the royal family was like 2018. So yeah, he didn't say anything. So I think this brings us to the final recipe item, which is the turn to tragedy.
Mm-hmm. So I would say all of this kind of ends around March 22nd when we get a video from Kate Middleton herself. It is her sitting on a bench telling us that she was diagnosed with cancer.
In January, I underwent major abdominal surgery in London, and at the time, it was thought that my condition was non-cancerous. The surgery was successful. However, tests after the operation found cancer had been present. My medical team therefore advised that I should undergo a course of preventative chemotherapy, and I'm now in the early stages of that treatment.
I would actually like to ask you guys, specifically Mike, where were you when you saw this video, and like, what did you immediately feel?
I was writing for NeverPost. I was writing an intro where I knew that we were going to have to talk about Kate Middleton. Mm. And I saw the thing. And I think Hans and I both posted the exact same link to the post in the NeverPost Slack at the exact same time because we were like, oh, this changes everything. Because we had made a joke about it in the previous episode. And now we were like, well, now we got to talk about it and maybe not make a joke this time.
Yeah, I think we were in a similar position here on ICYMI. I think we had honestly joked about it a fair amount leading up to the video coming out. And I think we were actually in a meeting when the video came out and we were just getting slacks of people saying, Kate released a video. And I remember asking our coworkers to please summarize their live watch because I was doing something else. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking at that moment, God damn, the palace fucked this up.
Yeah.
I felt a moment of guilt. And then that very swiftly vanished because why did they do it like this? This is not my fault for speculating. They could have managed this so much more effectively and they chose not to. Because, reminder, the monarchy are heads of state. They're not just regular celebrities or rich people. And you can, of course, argue about how big of a role they have or how the monarchy functions, but they're still heads of state.
Yeah. I think the crown, specifically Queen Elizabeth II, is notorious for having this phrase, which is never complain, never explain. They say it in the crown. And to me, I felt this was so true in the way that that institution conducts everything. Because when we talk about the page 6 Kensington Palace, don't talk to us as per my last email. When we talk about the Photoshop and all that stuff, those were defensive, but they were not explanatory. And so that was them being like, I'm not going to explain this, but I will defend us for a little bit saying, get off my back. But the thing is, in this era, you can't really go with the never complain, never explain thing. Look at Prince Harry. Is his book not an entire book of HR complaints? And then look at never explain. Kate's video was a very clear explanation. And that was the thing that ended all the speculation. And so guess what, guys? Sometimes the queen is wrong.
It's funny. It's like, it makes me think of This Is Fine, right? Like they're trying to, this is fine, the whole situation. But like, that is a ubiquitous meme of a room on fire. Like you can't, this is fine things anymore. Cause I think people's base understanding of the world is that things are not fine. It's not fine. And we know it's not fine. You should just tell us the ways in which it's not fine.
Yeah. And I do think this video in itself kind of effectively cleared the decks of basically all speculation. It kind of cleared everyone's names. You know, she says in the video that William has been a great source of comfort and was by her side. And so they are clearly still a united front. So unfortunately, he is not the perpetrator no more.
It's interesting to compare all of this to something like Ocean Gate, which was received less sympathetically, pretty much immediately, and like almost all the way across the board. Would we have reacted differently to Ocean Gate if anybody had lived, if the CEO had lived? There was a teenager who was on there because it was like he was going as a, I think, Father's Day present to his dad, who's also on, but he like really didn't want to go. I wonder, like, if he had survived, like, would our reaction to this have been different? Is it easy to just really kind of like victim blame, honestly, because like no one came back and there's no one to like hold the public accountable? It's just all of us being like, you fucked up, huh?
You done goofed. Mm-hmm. I think the reaction to Ocean Gate would have been much different had someone survived, especially I think the 19-year-old passenger. I think there would have just been far more sympathy. And I think even when it was revealed that this 19-year-old was on the submersible, the conversation shifted like a little bit within the realms of the internet I was on. There was a little bit more sympathy allowed for the people who were on there because there was at least one person that we were like, you know what? Actually, this is sad. This is a tragedy. This isn't just rich people.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that the monoculture moment isn't so much what happened to Kate, but what happened to us as a collective society where everyone just like became a conspiracy theorist for 3 months and just accepted the delusion juice we were drinking.
Ooh, delusion juice. And that is something actually that we're really interested in over at NeverPost. So if it's okay, I would like to bring in the NeverPost team to talk about what this moment did for our collective online empathy. Do we all want to retract half of our jokes? Like, what percentage of the jokes do we want to have stand once we have all of the information of these various monocultural events? And like, you know, after Kate, how do we decide what's okay to speculate on? You know, what's the appropriate reaction to a monocultural event going forward?
And I'm really excited to get into that. So come back on Saturday, y'all, where we will all be talking about human empathy online and how we will remember Kate Gate in the years to come. And Mike, we will see you on Saturday.
See you on Saturday.
All right. That's the show. We want to thank Mike Rugnetta for joining us on today's show. You can find him and the Never Post podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We will be back in your feed on Saturday with the second part of today's conversation, so definitely subscribe. That way you never miss an episode. Please leave a rating and review in Apple or Spotify and tell your friends about us. You can follow us on Twitter at @icymi_pod, and you can always drop us a note at icymi@slate.com.
ICYMI is produced by Sierra Spragley-Ricks, Rachel Hampton, and me, Candace Lim. Daisy Rosario is our senior supervising producer, and Alicia Montgomery is Slate's vice president of audio. This episode was made in collaboration with the NeverPost team, which includes Hans Buteau, Jason Oberholzer, Mike Rugnetta, and Will Williams. See you online.
Or on the NeverPost podcast.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines.
With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.